we have someone who I know you, Ellen, and I, too, hope will become a regular on our show, Dr. Paul Spector. And, you know, just for our listeners, we like to say Dr. Paul Spector because, you know, that's like it makes us really credible. And I should warn you, the reason Ellen really wants you on regularly is because she figures she can save a couple bucks from going to the doctor.
Why not?
You got to get really close to the mic.
Yeah.
But I said, Ellen, let's talk about, you know, the things he writes about. And Dr. Paul Spector writes, you know, after your last appearance, I actually got an email saying, or was it a text? Or, it was an email, I think, asking me, who was that on your show? I really want to, you know, follow up and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So you have at least one fan already.
Yeah.
Do you have time to have new patients?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I call them clients, though, because
I see.
I don't see it as really practicing medicine. It's more trying to create a preventive health perspective for them and change the trajectory maybe that they're on that they want to head towards.
I'm on a regimen of not eating sweets. And I'm failing.
See, I told you she's going to.
Here we go. Let the games begin.
What do you mean you're failing?
Well, because I just decided that I was going to processed sugar was not. I needed to get it out of my life.
Yeah.
Because it's so bad for you.
But when you say sweets, there's plenty of sweets that don't involve processed sugar.
Exactly. So,
oh, thank you. Call me Dr. Tom.
So I was standing in my kitchen, and after I've had dinner, I want something sweet. I mean, that's just the...
Sure.
Everybody does, don't they? So I looked. I found two cookies in my house. I ate the cookies.
Who left them there? Where did they
I had purchased them a long time ago. They weren't exactly terribly fresh. But there are these little Madeleines that this certain bakery,
Entenmann's.
Commercial bakery, Entenmann's, yeah, makes. And I buy at the supermarket. And you look at the ingredients, and it's mostly sugar and butter. I mean, it's not full of other junk, but sugar is and butter are bad enough.
Well, you know, that's why the Entenmann's of my youth was always valued for that reason. They were very fresh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You didn't grow up in the New York region, did you?
No.
Entenmann's was kind of a local.
Okay.
Expanding. Now it's taken over by somebody. But the whole thing about Entenmann's, even though it was a separate rack of things, it was always very fresh. So they obviously didn't use a lot of, you know, the junk that you need to preserve. Yeah.
Right. So it didn't have the junk, but it had the, you know, sugar and butter.
Mm.
So I ate those. Then I wasn't satisfied because I hadn't had any chocolate. So
you dunked them in chocolate.
No. I had a handful of blueberries, fresh blueberries.
Beautiful.
Oh, that was good.
Yeah.
But you still wanted chocolate.
I had raisins. I had to, like, scrape them out of the bottom of this container. I was like an addict, like a sugar addict.
Well, what did Michael Pollan say? He said, if it comes from a plant, eat it. If it's made in a plant, don't eat it.
There you go.
Oh, very good. Okay.
Yeah, he's clever, that Michael Pollan.
He's great, isn't he?
Yeah.
2 days later, I went to the drugstore because I needed something in the drugstore. And Ghirardelli, they were having a sale in Ghirardelli.
That's a plot.
No. I thought... I'll try eating just one square of chocolate because somebody did a test and said it's good for you if it has
dark.
If it's very high content cocoa.
Yeah.
So if you bought one bar you could get the second one for 50%
off. Ellie.
So I was going to bring it today because I thought we could have a test. I mean, it was like
a test to see if I could resist.
One was 86% cocoa and the other is only 70 something.
What were you going to test?
We can tell
better?
The difference. I don't know.
Okay, well.
Anyway, on to the real stuff.
Oh, that's
here.
Not building up to a question?
No. No, just to say. It's really hard to do, but
yeah.
I have to have the right food in my house if I'm going to do it.
Mm.
Okay. Fruit.
So,
what it means,
you
fruit.
Know, one of the many things Should we just like call him Dr. Paul? Like, you know, like
that's good.
Dr.
That's
Paul does. One of the main things Dr. Paul Spector does is write for Huffington Post. So if you go online to Huffington Post, you can just put in his name, Paul Spector, and you'll get his archive of articles there, as well as a brief biography. Did you read the brief biography, Ellen?
Yes.
Good. Okay.
Yes, Professor. Thank you.
I was hoping you'd, you know, like add a couple things. Like, no? Okay. No, so I, you read the article. And his latest piece was on the science of truth in the age of fake news. Now, Ellen, you might know, is very obsessed with fake news. She's constantly claiming
the propagator.
Yeah.
Oh, because Tom is always trying to be funny by saying false things about me.
Well, yeah, you know, because I'm trying to explain to Ellen that we're on radio. No one can see us. We can make up stuff.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
And it's not like I make up, you know, like there's a war of the worlds going on or something like that.
No, but you depict me as being quite an alcoholic.
Oh, that's a long. Drinker that's old of news. Alcohol. That is not fake. That is old news.
Old fake news.
Old fake news. And
I'm a chocoholic. Yes. I will confess to that.
So Ellen, you know, is constantly yelling out fake news, fake news. which I got to say is better since she doesn't tweet it, as some people do. Anyway, so what's interesting about your article, of course, is that you talk about it from a scientific point of view.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because, you know, as a culture, we've developed quite a peculiar flexibility in being able to tolerate different levels of truth. I mean, the fact that, you know, politicians can give a speech and then it's just you have these people do fact checking afterward, and that's an accepted.
Right.
So there's a level of deceit that is tolerated, but it seems like we're pushing the boundaries of that these days. But I thought it'd be interesting to look at what is the optimal possible. You know, how honest can we be? And the science suggests that we're not wired for truth.
Mm-hmm.
Not surprisingly, you know, if you look at an evolutionary model, the brain's task isn't so much to depict a, you know, absolutely accurate version of what's out there. It's to depict what's out there in a way that's going to be adaptive.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I mean, you know, that you're going to survive and you're going to reproduce, which often entails all sorts of deception,
mm-hmm.
Enhancing your self-worth or your danger to an enemy or your social standing. And it's just very interesting, some of the research that's come out of that field now, where, for instance, one area that's come up from is behavioral economics. And Kahneman, who's one of my favorite, mm-hmm. you know, guys as a go-to in terms of understanding culture. And he pointed out that we have these two selves. We have an experiencing self and we have a remembering self. Mm. And the experiencing self is the you who is in the midst of life and having the experience. And of course, the historical part is the remembering self is the one that records what's happened. And they don't agree with each other. And it's not that that's a flaw. It's a design feature. It's hardwired. So,
and when you say hardwired and everything, you mean it's kind of like our adaptive Darwinian development as human beings?
Exactly.
Okay.
It seems as if you do a huge amount. There was one interesting study that I think I mentioned in that article. It might have been another one where they've looked at people's reality testing across a spectrum of affective, you know, states. So they'll go from really depressed, moderately depressed, normal, hypomanic, manic, right? And then give these people questionnaires and how accurately do they depict, you know, their environment. And what they found was people who are mildly depressed have the most accurate reality testing. So a feature of health is actually distorting reality.
I love that, because what it's saying, you know, I've always thought that you're depressed because you actually know what's going on in the world. You know? It makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and another thing to point out, of course, is the legal ramifications of all this. My wife, as Ellen might know, has worked with the Innocence Project, and you know they're vehement about this business of witness identifications. It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's really, really difficult for someone to pick somebody out of an equal lineup
absolutely
accurately.
Well, there's so many things involved. Old joke in legal circles is, you know, the only thing worse than one eyewitness is two eyewitnesses, because they'll never, ever agree, right? You know, the whole concept of memory is being reassessed, and I think the legal field is one of many that's going to be transformed, mm-hmm. because asking someone their recollection will be laughed at, I think, in the near future.
Right, and all these people being let out, it's because real science prevails, and that is to say DNA testing and things like that. Which in itself isn't, I mean, it has a small degree of a fallibility too, doesn't it, or not?
Tiny,
yeah, okay. But yeah. I mean, I guess, yeah, I'm thinking of one of those John Grisham novels where somebody actually, you know, uses somebody else's DNA. So it's still DNA. But yeah, and tell us more about Daniel Kahneman. Is this that popular book? Not popular, but that slow?
Yeah, it's Fast Thinking, Slow Thinking, which is sort of a compendium of
his
whole...
He's a Nobel Prize winner in economics, right?
Behavioral economics. There was also a terrific book that was written about him and his collaborator, who I'm blocking on now. They're two Israelis, and they had this incredible relationship where the sum of their minds was so much greater than either one alone. And it was really
That's
very
like
much...
That's like Ellen and me.
I think so, yeah.
he says something and I deny it.
I'm sorry.
But I mean, you know, one of the things that was striking was he showed that there are certain rules that you can say are, you know, in the design of the way we recall things. One is that we have very little, if any, memory of duration of an episode. What we remember is the peak emotional experience or sensation, like if it was a painful thing, and we remember the end. So. I thought that was quite interesting because what it suggests is the way you say goodbye to someone is very important. It's more important than how you say hello to them, mm-hmm. Or how long you spend with them. The way that you break up the interaction is what's going to be remembered most. And memory, you know, is something that I think industry has cashed in. I mean, we realize that business, taking pictures, for instance, is such an important thing now. Everybody has a phone. If you had asked me 10 years ago, hey, you know, let's put a phone with a camera in it, I'd say no one's going to use it. I think it's
little did you know.
Yeah, I've been wrong about every one of those.
You're not a prognosticator,
no.
That's clear.
But people now, I think, are almost more caught up with creating the memory than having the experience.
This is an ongoing battle at home.
Yeah.
Because my wife is obsessed with taking... She's calmed down a little bit. I mean, I can't stand it in the restaurant when she photographs her food. And it's
yeah.
like, just eat the god darn stuff. You know what I mean? It just drives me nuts. But, you know, I did have the regret recently that I didn't take more pictures when I traveled when I was younger. So, I mean, there's both kind of things. But, yeah, no, she's an obsessive photo taker. And it's like, strange to me.
She has to have something to put on Facebook.
There you go. She's also a Facebooker. Although she's calming down on that, thank God.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Yeah, right, since the new revelations.
But, you know, it's
by the way, we're talking to Dr. Paul Spector, who we're hoping will become a regular on our show.
This is the Thursday afternoon show.
And who are you?
I'm Ellen Thurston.
And I'm Tom DiPietro. And again, we're talking to Dr. Paul Spector.
Yes, we are.
Huffington Post and a local practitioner of a new kind of holistic health.
Exactly.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt
No,
you.
So, you know, one of the... you know, interesting questions that Kahneman poses in that book, you know, and there's sort of two types of people with regard to this, you know, recording versus experiencing. He poses this question, if you could take two vacations, one vacation would be the most incredible vacation you've ever had in your life, and another would be just a good vacation. Which would you choose? But the caveat is, the incredible vacation, you'd have no memory of it. I've asked a lot of people this. 99% of them say, what's the point if I can't remember it? I said I would take the fabulous one. I'd have the experience.
I would too, because I've actually had vacations where I don't have a single one. That cruise I took in the Caribbean. Oh, my God. I don't even.
But it's an interesting question, right? I mean, why would an experience only be valued if it could be recalled?
Right. I always tease my wife that it's a very Protestant thing that she feels that way, that she has to be making something and has to have a record of it, you know, because she always has to be doing something that has some kind of output or end point, you know? And me being the free-spirited Latin, I just like, hey, I don't give a hell. You know, I'm in it. I'm in it. That's it.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're talking about these, you know, adaptive behaviors and everything, sometimes I wonder if, you know, don't we, to a degree, fight some of these behaviors? I mean, we are adaptive animals and all that, but to the point that we're more, what, civilized or advanced or whatever, sometimes we work against those kind of
absolutely
built-in things.
Absolutely. But I think that the sort of thing that we're talking about now in terms of recollection, for instance, brain function, there is no conscious capacity. I mean, we were talking earlier today. Memory is not, you know, pulling up an old record from the files, like this computer model kind of thing. Memory is something that's constantly being refashioned with ongoing experience. So the event that is being recalled has been edited over and over again by all the experience you've had since that event. It doesn't bear much resemblance to it, but it's meaningful. You know,
right.
It's, and that's adaptive
it's,
in
it still
many ways.
Resonates in our daily life, even if it's false.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, I guess, what they, how all these weird memory situations come up, like the people who think they've had weird experiences and really didn't,
right?
You know, or I remember there was that Harvard professor wrote about the McMartin School and creating memories in the children that they'd been abused when they'd never happened.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
Yeah.
So you can not only can you not remember things, but you can actually plant memory by just repeating things over and over
and editing it
and get till they get it right. What about you, Ellen?
What about me?
which vacation
do you remember
would you
what
take?
We're talking about?
Oh, which vacation would I take? Either the most wonderful one ever, or what was the alternative?
Just a good vacation,
oh, good vacation.
But you'd remember it.
Would you remember to talk into the microphone, Ellen, please?
Yes, I will. No, I won't. Obviously, I haven't.
That's Alan Thurston, by the way.
I wish I remembered your name. I would tell him.
Tom DiPietro. And we're talking
yes, that's
Dr.
Tom
Paul
DiPietro.
Spector.
That's right. That's
makes
a hard
sound
one.
So classy, doesn't
that's
it?
A hard
we're talking
one.
To Dr. Paul Spector.
I don't see. I'd want to know where first before I have to make a
move. Need more information.
We had a thing here once where we were asking hypotheticals, and Ellen refused when we were on the Drive Time show. Ellen refused to answer any of them because she'd always say, "Well, what about this? What about?" It's like, come on, Ellen, play along for crying out loud! It's radio, fake news. So the other thing that came to mind when I was reading your article from HuffPost or Huffington Post, we insiders call it HuffPost, by the way.
Well, I saw it said HuffPost.
Oh,
at
did
the
it?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Was that it's not really saying there isn't truth. It's just saying our abilities to recapture certain truths is hampered by all these biological things.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one interesting one that's kind of get a laugh is there's differences between men and women and their perception of things that is defined by the way the brain is made to work. It's not a design flaw. Mm. It's so, for instance, men over-perceive the interest of women in themselves.
Oh, yeah,
and
right.
over-respond to that perceived, their perception that the woman is interested. And
that's
the woman is just the opposite.
Trouble.
Yeah.
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 I think it's interesting to know these things, though, because it tells you a lot about
And that's all related to the biological imperative of men wanting to procreate, women wanting to select the best person to procreate with, and
right,
and
so
as much as we deny that intellectually, it's still kind of in our whatever makeup.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not an excuse for any kind of behavior,
no,
of course,
right.
But it is an explanation.
Sorry for coming on strong that time, Ellen.
No, you're not.
There's another
See,
funny
one. See, I can
one.
Tell he's not telling the truth. I can tell it right away.
You know, in looking at some of this stuff, one of the things I got into was self-deception. Which is a sort of class unto itself,
yes.
And is equally powerful. We were just saying, you know, how health is not defined by great reality testing necessarily. They've shown in, you know, the medical field that the more positive you are, without any data to back up that positivity, the better your outcome. You'll do better.
Health-wise,
yeah.
You mean. Yeah.
That's what I always thought, Ellen. It's good to be dumb and happy.
But faith, you know, it takes on faith. A whole different.
Right, and those are some of the, you know, those kind of religious people who are always trying to prove, in quotation marks, that prayer works, you know? And this is kind of what you're talking about. It's not that, quote, prayer works in any scientific sense. It just makes them a more positive person and probably helps their outlook on whatever's ailing them.
Or something right. Like, so it, you know? So it ends up being true in some, you know, some, distant way.
Right.
But yeah, if you believe that you're going to be better, you're changing your internal chemistry in a way that favors your getting better.
But of course, it never works when people actually have, like, you know, stage 4 cancer. You know what I mean? Prayer is not going to get you. It might extend your life some, but it's not going to cure it. Probably.
Probably not. Yeah. But it might, you know, in terms of pain management, for instance, they've shown tremendous differences in you know, the belief, faith that you're going to be taken care of.
Which, you know, raises issues, moral issues that are just, like, really tough. Like, you know, what if you're not a positive person and you have stage 4 cancer and you say, look, I'm not, this is going to be hell for me. Why can't I just end it? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But these are our biological imperatives, Ellen. Mm-hmm. Do you feel them strongly?
You know,
you want to ask, are you going to ask him for a prescription to something?
No.
You know, another interesting one that's universal is this, they call it the better than average perception, where almost everyone thinks they're better than average, which obviously is impossible. And you have people who, for instance, you can be asking them about their driving, and they've had a series of accidents. They've been hospitalized. I mean, the data is staring them in the face. And they would well, I'm better than average.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they believe that. Yeah. It's not a lie. Or another one that's really interesting. They took people, you know, if you hear your voice, you have a physiological response that they can measure on your skin, a galvanic skin response called. And it's different than when you hear someone else's voice. And it's a good biological marker that does not change no matter what happens to you in terms of your mood. But if you do something to a subject that lowers their self-esteem, they will not recognize their voice as often, but the galvanic skin response will remain intact. So there's something
your body's
that goes
reacting,
on.
It's going to react the same no matter what. Your head is in a different place, sort of.
Right. So and clearly that has to be coordinated by the brain.
Yeah.
So what's happening, and we know this, we just have a lot of trouble accepting it, is that the brain basically is going to control what it allows you to know. You know, we think we're in control.
Mm-hmm.
We're not.
You're not in control, Tom.
Oh, I know that. Trust me. when my wife's here, I know it's a...
But I think like to believe that, you know...
That we're controlling all our actions. I did this because I want to do this.
Yeah.
No, not true.
And, you know, I take the data. I look at it. I make a decision.
Yeah.
You know, rational man. That's why economics was such crap, I think, for so long, because it was a model based on rational man.
Right.
You know, you make a decision based on whether it's good for you or bad for you. Medicine, similar, right? And then they find out, well, not so much.
And that's what behavioral economics is about,
exactly.
Essentially, right?
Yeah.
I'm just seeing that there's more to it than just playing with statistics.
Yeah.
The troubling sort of part of, or let's say the troubling consequence of what you say in your article is that, you know, it does suggest that there's a certain value in lying of a certain kind.
No question.
Which is something that's hard for people to accept, you know, because all of us like to think honesty is the best policy. Well, it's not always the best policy.
No.
I always tell Ellen her clothes look fantastic. And of course, in that case, it's true because she has a great color palette. But there are other people, you know, I'll say, you know, oh, you look great. Yeah, right. Or as you say, you know, is my butt big?
Does this make me look fat?
This make me fat, yeah. And you can't answer that, honestly. You're not supposed to.
Right.
I mean, trying to create a computer program of human honesty, I think, would be quite difficult.
It's funny you mention that because I just finished a book called Life in Code.
Okay.
Came out last year by a woman named Ellen Ullman. And she's a sort of recovering programmer. She spent 30 years in the business.
And, wow.
You know, at the highest levels at one point. And that's kind of one of the things she talks about. It's just the whole false premises of AI research. You know, it's just crazy that they think they can recreate certain aspects of human behavior. And especially, as you were saying, there's all these kind of back and forth things that happens, you know, in how we remember and how, you know, and it's she talks about a cat, you know, because some people like try start with animals because they figure that'll be easier.
Huh.
You know,
like yeah.
That's how a
right.
And Ellen will tell you, no way, no computer could recreate her cat.
Yeah,
and all the love that she gets
from
that.
I have two cats, a girl and a boy, siblings.
Oh.
And they act just like live people do in their moods and, you know, when they choose to fight each other and all of that.
That's what this one was saying. She said, you know, someone just made a nasty comment to her once with, oh, your cat just loves you because you bring it food. Well, of course there's that biological imperative, but there's also a lot of other things, even with an animal. You know,
sure.
Going back and forth that are developing that could not be predicted by a artificially intelligent cat. And certainly when you get to the human level and you're talking about consciousness and the brain and memory and all the stuff we've been talking about, it's like,
yeah.
Forget it. And why? That's the other question. Why do these AI people like Ray Kurzweil and all those guys want to do this?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Why? Why do you want to replace human beings?
Yeah.
To prove that you can.
To prove that you can.
Yeah, I mean, the whole project of trying to download from a human brain, you know,
yeah.
And this immortality dream of, you know, just put it into another. We are an animal.
Yeah.
You know, there's no escaping it. And we're the product of, you know, million years of evolution. And
speaking of animals, as opposed to us as animals, and your article, do you think... household or regular animals lie in the same way we do? Or do they always work from a more biological, a kind of truth-telling?
I think that it's, most of it's hardwired in the same way that it is for us,
right.
Actually. You know, I think that the difference is that I think we are better at deceiving ourselves and have a different kind of relationship with ourselves probably than, you know, a snake... or a chameleon or something that can take on the markings of a poisonous snake that's not a poisonous snake.
Right.
I doubt that the snake is involved other than some reflex mechanism of, you know, fear and something's
fear.
Going on and this happens. Whereas I think we're a little closer to...
A dog can pretend, right? I mean, that's kind of...
Yeah.
Well, they do that when they're playing. I think there's a form
play.
Of play.
Right.
Yeah.
And they have guilt. Mm-hmm. And they, I think, try to hide misdeeds, I think.
Dogs do more than cats, I think.
Cats don't care, do they?
They don't.
They don't.
They're
arrogant little buggers.
They don't.
Yeah.
They don't, but they do sometimes. I don't know. They're complex. You can't herd cats, for example.
Right.
I mean, you can, but it's hard.
You should see me at a common council meeting.
Well, that's, it's a good, good example.
Yeah.
But, you know, you say, is there anything that we can do? I mean, is it just hardwired? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think you can do is look at why people lie and what might be going on institutionally to... make it that more likely to, like, you know, one of the interesting things I remember reading about Japanese culture is that loss of face is a tremendous, you know, thing. And to acknowledge having made a mistake is sort of, it's almost culturally accepted that you're not expected to do that because that would be too hurtful to yourself and also destroy your reputation. But that lends itself to a certain kind of lying.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, now if you look at, I think also one of the big things that's affected the situation is technology. So much communication now isn't face-to-face. And talk about what we're wired for. you know, the best way to get a lie through is not to be in communication.
Funny you mentioned this, because in the same book by Ellen Ullman, she talks about how the internet and the computer in general has wiped out intermediation in so many of our relationships in the world. I mean, think of our commercial life. I mean, our consumptive life consumption life, brokers and all these other people we used to deal with as intermediaries.
Absolutely.
And who, by the way, made up a big part of the middle class. This is part of the reason they're gone.
Yeah.
Because of the internet.
Yeah.
But also this direct communication. We have a president who communicates through Twitter. The notion that you would just say something like that without any consultation with anybody, and obviously ill serves him, but ill serves everyone.
Yeah.
In any context.
And it's much more difficult to assess the truth value of a statement,
yeah,
if it's in print.
And worse,
disembodied.
When it is proven to be false, it's like, well, maybe they've forgotten by then, you know?
Yeah.
But
crazy.
Poor Mr. Trump doesn't have the words to express himself. No, seriously, I don't think he has a vocabulary. He doesn't read. I think there's a real deficit there. And that comes through.
Yes, Ellen, but what we're saying...
I feel sorry for him
but
sometimes.
But what we're saying here, though, is if he had an intermediary, which is to say that huge group of advisors who he should be talking to before he says anything, they would give him the words and help him, you know?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it's the same phenomenon you're talking about, you know? It's just...
But that's why he repeats himself a lot.
But don't you think the public has a curious tolerance?
Oh, yeah.
Not just Trump, but... for being lied to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not Ellen. Not Ellen. Oh, no.
No.
Oh, no.
No, I think they do. We do.
I mean, how can you have someone give a speech to the nation, whoever they are, whatever politician, and then afterward they go through and they go, this was true, this wasn't true, this wasn't true, this was true, true,
it's unbelievable,
false. And there's no consequence.
How about the phenomenon on Facebook where people post fake news and there's always I'm not going to say smart person, but one clever person who goes to Snopes.com and reveals that the whole trend, the whole, what's the word they use for?
Chain
transcript?
Or something.
Yeah, well, you know, what did you say?
Chain?
The whole chain, thank you.
Yeah.
The whole chain was all about something that never was true in the first place.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Well, they do it because they can.
Yeah, and it's not new, obviously,
right,
this whole thing. But I think that, as you were saying, the world's gotten so separated from the communicator. We're not in the same room. We don't see the face. We don't see the body language. And I think it totally compromises our ability to begin to assess. And, you know, I think gossip was also a testing ground of, you think that's true? I don't know. How's that? You know, and it would get batted around.
Right. Understood that it was gossip.
Right.
And it may or may not be true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now we just say, oh, that's true.
Well, I think, if you'll pardon me for saying this, Tom, but I think a lot of people do not trust politicians, you know, as a group.
Oh, yeah. Don't trust me.
Yeah. No, and for good reason.
Yeah. For good reason.
Yeah. And I guess they have to protect themselves. Occasionally.
Well, can we shift gears with Dr. Paul Spector here for a second, Ellen?
Sure.
Apparently you, Ellen, have been attending his class at the library.
That is the core strength and balance class.
Right, right.
And I found myself enjoying it more the second class.
Are you doing pirouettes?
No, not yet.
Oh, you're doing great.
Not yet.
Not yet, okay.
See? Cool. I'm doing great.
You are. You are.
How do I know? Because my doctor said so.
I really enjoy that so much. It's such a great gang of people.
And when is it again? What time?
It's Saturday, 1:30 at the library.
At the Hudson Library on North Fifth Street.
And you can call and sign up.
Very group of people.
It's jam-packed, right? I mean, it's hard to get in, apparently.
Yeah.
Standing room only.
Yeah.
It's nice. So tell us about it, Ellen. What do you think?
I think... I made progress even after the first class.
Absolutely.
Because I found myself being, this is crazy to say in a way, I found myself to be less fearful of, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly jumping across a pile of snow, but I think people fall sometimes they're, you know, trepidatious.
Yeah. When you get scared, the motor pattern is disrupted, it's and different. You're sort of more vulnerable.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So now you know how to, like, fall and roll?
Not yet.
Not I would yet. Love to be able to do that. We don't have the
if we had an entire room.
Things, but really? Old people could? Sorry. People of a certain age can do that?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Where does that age start?
I'd say around 30.
Yeah.
I'm serious.
I know plenty of people who are out of shape in such a way that if they fell, they'd really hurt themselves.
Yeah.
Even at that age.
Or you even just test balance.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just human. If you don't use it.
Right.
You know, you lose the capacity. Yeah. And how often do we move? For instance, I have the people walk backwards. I have them walk to the side. I have them do that in front, behind, in front. Mm-hmm. Even things like opposite swings, which is essential to balance, that the opposite arm and leg are going forward as you walk.
Oh, that explains why you see those old people walking around the streets going like this. Like, what the hell are they doing with their arms? It's cute. But, you know, after you were last here and said this about how, you know, get all those parts of your body that you don't normally move in that position, I've taken that as a cue to go dancing a lot. Not formal
dancing.
Dancing's
fantastic.
But even, you know, just like working Hip-hop. Up a sweat on the dance floor.
It's the best.
It's a lot of fun. And now I have an excuse, you know? I don't care if I look like a pathetic old guy trying to look young. Because, you know, it's not ballroom dancing or something that Ellen would do, but...
You know, they say that dancing is one of the best exercises because not just the physical, but it's social. You're moving in all directions. You're learning something new in terms of, you know, movement, motor patterns. And it's fun.
Yeah. One of the things I've learned is that there's a lot of cute young women who will dance with me. It's amazing to me.
Reason to stay in shape.
Exactly. Reason to stay in shape.
Wow.
So what are you working on? What's your next HuffPost piece going to be about, Dr. Paul Spector?
I'm in the midst of writing about cleaning products and what they do to you. I've gotten very interested in environmental toxins in the home. And
we talked a little bit about that last time.
Yeah.
And I read something about that recently.
Yeah, there have been a bunch of studies that have come out recently that are showing that exposure to a lot of the typical normal run-of-the-mill cleaning products, it's like smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. And so they've studied different populations. They studied cleaning people, who it's their profession, and they have it the worst, obviously. But just people, male or female, who are in the home and they're the ones who do the cleaning, are having lung disease on a level that you would never anticipate.
It actually doesn't surprise me because some of that stuff is... I mean, all you have to do is look at it.
Yeah. The 16 ingredients. But you know what's interesting to me about the story, as much as anything else, is the culture's relationship to clean. There's this kind of perverse thing that I think advertising cultivated, clearly. You know, and some of the old ads are really amazing. Always a bridesmaid, never a bride. You know, and it's an ad for some kind of soap. You know, this notion that... We live in a time where you'd rather smell like some tropical fruit than a human being, you know?
Yeah.
This whole notion of clean is very recent.
I don't know if you've noticed, Ellen, but, you know, I got tired of using deodorant. Because, I mean, you're putting... It's amazing what people put under their arms, you know? You think I stink, but I don't. So what I do, because I've been reading what the young people do, they put on this crystal stuff.
Yeah. You know? Salt.
Works fine.
Yeah.
Works fine.
Yeah.
Crystal, can you buy that in the drugstore?
Yes, you can.
You can now.
Yeah, with a little applicator and all that kind of stuff. You know, you don't have to like take a hard crystal and rub it in your armpit.
But it's not just cleaning products. I mean, some of the, like, you know, the receipts you get out of an ATM
are
laden with this carcinogenic stuff. Or the stuff that you put in the dryer.
And it's freshly printed, so it's probably getting on your fingers pretty easy.
You have to wash your hands every minute.
I remember my awareness of this.
Just don't touch it.
The Sunday paper, the Sunday New York Times would come.
It'd be black.
And it wasn't just that. The whole thing would just make me sneeze like crazy. Not the daily paper, but whatever was in that Sunday paper in terms of all the, you know, because there's different types of printing. There was the color. And I had a hard time reading it because it was making me sneeze so much. And not a lot makes me sneeze.
Interesting.
But yeah, no, there's tons of these things, and it's really frightening sometimes, especially if you're of a certain age where you know you've been around them your whole life. What do you do? You start using crystals on your armpits. Yeah.
But it's wild to me that, you know, you grow up thinking, The government's got your back. They would never allow something that was known to be, especially if they're getting bankrupted by the healthcare bill. Why would they allow? But it's not so. You know, you grow up thinking, well, I mean, biologically, we must need three meals a day. No.
No, somebody decided years ago that dinner would be at 6 and lunch would be at 12. And
it was a factory schedule, really, right? I mean, it was based on industry. It was based on money.
You know, I was I noticed earlier that Ellen mentioned she was in a drugstore where she bought her chocolate. And it is kind of amazing that you can go into a drugstore and find so many products that are just like helping the drugstore exist. You know what I mean? By creating, you know, diabetics and everything else.
Yeah. I want to know what's in toothpaste.
Yeah, there's some bad.
Does it list ingredients on toothpaste?
The ones I get.
Yeah, there's antibacterial agents now, sometimes even, you know, forms of antibiotic that...
Oh, my God.
You know, one of the things that is most dangerous about clean is that we're wiping out all these bacterial populations that we need, that we've evolved with and that are part of our defense, and they keep bad bacterial populations at bay. And, you know, you buy a cutting board, a lot of them are impregnated with antibacterial agents.
Mm. Ugh.
You know, this hand cleanser that people think are constantly...
Oh, yeah, that I don't
get. Not a
get.
Good idea.
I don't get.
The whole concept of clean, you know, can I see myself in my plates? I mean, just these perverse, my toilet bowl, my shower, the whole thing.
Know,
I don't know what it is.
I've had no cold or anything this entire winter, and I attribute it to going to the CrossFit where there's germs everywhere.
Yeah.
We're constantly on the floor picking up germs, handling other people's stuff. Not a single cold or anything.
Right.
I mean, it could be, you know, a magical thinking, but it
no, I think
everybody else in my family has been sick.
No, you need anti whatever.
Biotics?
No, not antibiotics. Bugs that fight the bad bugs.
Probiotics.
Yeah.
Probiotics.
Yeah, but just thank bacterial you. Populations, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Ellen.
Oh, wait, absolutely.
Did you get, I forgot. Did you get your... Was it a PhD or
my
an
PhD?
MD?
No. I got my MFA.
Ah, okay. That exceeds them all. Well, we've been talking to Dr. Paul Spector, and while we say goodbye, I found a song that sort of speaks to what we've just been talking about. Listen
really?
To this.
A song for every occasion.
Song for every occasion, that's right. Start talking.
Your hands in it, plant your roots in it, dusty headlight dance with your boots in it.
Dirt. Well, dirt.
That's great.
You write her name on
I didn't know you were a country guy.
I'm not really.
Build your cornfield whiskey bonfires on it.
Dirt.
You bet your life on it.
Oh, that red dress clay. That's good stuff, too, right?
Yeah.
They say that's really got a lot of... I mean, people used to eat it.
Yep. No, I mean, you know, you have a whole generation of kids who've grown up and they have allergies like we've never seen before. And
because they're too clean.
They're too clean. And also, every time they had a cold, they were given antibiotics. I mean, the number of courses of antibiotics are just mind-boggling.
Well, Paul, as in Dr. Paul Spector, thank you for coming in again.
My pleasure.
I hope you'll come back.
Absolutely.
It's been great.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, we have a little business
fun.
To
we'll
do
see
before
you soon.
We leave.
Okay.
But thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Bye.
Good speaking to you.
Paul Spector, Dr. Paul Spector. If you want to know about him, go to HuffPost or Huffington Post, as Ellen knows it, and just put in his name, Dr. Paul Spector, and you'll see a biography all about him, what, you know, his credentials are, because, you know, who trusts anyone these days in this age of fake news?
Thank you, Paul.
A bunch of his articles.